Here we go.
Welcome to BP Wrigleycast, the Cubs podcast that looks at the game from the fans' point of view and from the analytical perspective. The Cubs are doing well again this week. They go 7-0, pretty dominating stretch of games. This is kind of where we want to open. You know, a lot of people said, you know, wait till they face the Pirates. It's going to be competitive. Well, the Nationals are coming to town. They're one of the best teams in the National League. And the Cubs just decided to sweep everything from everyone and go 7-0. So it's a pretty dominating stretch. They're off to a really good start. And I've had a couple of conversations with people this week just about how they can't remember this level of domination. And it's obviously such a good start. So my advice to Cubs fans out there is enjoy this, because it's pretty special right now and it's quite a ride. So let's go ahead and start with that. Ryan, any thoughts on how this dominating stretch that the Cubs are going through right now?
Yeah, I guess I just kind of piggyback on what you said, that it's a very special thing. We've never seen anything like this in our lifetime with the Cubs. I think we've seen stretches like this. Like last year, they probably went through a stretch of 30 games where they won probably 23, 24 of them, I would think, or at least something similar to that. But that was second half of the season. It wasn't like starting off the season like that. And I don't know. I mean, the Cub fan inside me wants to be kind of like uneasy about it, thinking, you know, is this not that they are completely overperforming, but, you know, is something going to change in, you know, the rest of the season where they're not going to be performing like this? But the example I would give would be the Cardinals last year started 22-7. So, you know, they ended up winning 100 games, but, you know, knocked out in the NLDS, and then injuries and, you know, just some underperformance. So that's where I am with it. I'm buying this as this team is this good right now, but it's such a long season. I really hope they're this good in October.
It definitely makes a difference knowing that every single game you just expect something to happen. You know, when if they get up to a 3-4 run lead early on, it's like, okay, they're probably going to hang on. And if they're down 3-4 runs, it's like, all right, well, somebody will come through and do something to make this a game again. So yeah, it's pretty incredible.
Yeah, it is. I'm not sure that as Cubs fans, we really can contextualize it too much. And I was discussing this with a friend who was hanging out with last night, and he said, something about this feels so different. And I said, well, I feel like whether we're behind or ahead, there's this comfort that I have this year that I've never really felt before. And I think it's what dominance feels like. And it would make sense that we've never felt that in regards to the Cubs before, because they've never really been dominant. So it's just, like on Saturday, I was following the game on GameCast and listening, and the Cubs were trailing the majority of the game, and there was really no part of me that thought, okay, they're going to lose, but by how much? It was, when's the rally coming? You know, and who's it going to be by? And it was a feeling I've never really felt for, is a sense of like comfort and almost peace, as corny as that sounds. But I think it's what Yankees fans had to have felt, you know, during the 90s and early 2000s. Just, okay, every game's going to be a win or very close to a win, so when's the rally? It's really interesting.
I mean, I agree. I was thinking about Yankees and also that Mariners team. I can't remember the year. Year when they won like 120 games or whatever it was.
Yeah, 2001.
Yeah, and just thinking, wow, you always observe those teams from afar, from the outside, saying, oh, that must be great to be on that team. Must be amazing to be a fan of that particular team going through that. But the other thing that I'm just like, I still can't wrap my head around is, it's not like everything is running smoothly. You know, you lose Schwarber. Hayward's not hitting. There's so many things that it's not like everybody's clicking and everything. You know, the numbers are off the charts, and it's like, okay, regression is going to come. Granted, regression will probably come on some of these players that are doing really well, Dexter Fowler in particular, but still, there's room for other people to kind of move up as these other ones regress. So it's just amazing to me that they're putting together these stretches of games when not everybody is, you know, overperforming. This is real dominance. This isn't just a fluke.
Yeah, that's Carlos. That's what I was thinking, and I touched on it last week at toward the end of the podcast, and we talked about it for a while. But you can make a pretty strong case that the offense has not. I don't know if you could say gotten near its potential, but it hasn't hit its potential, its ceiling. And I think there's a lot of room there. You know, first of all, you're missing Schwarber, and, you know, that's a sunk cost, I guess. I don't have a PhD in economics, so maybe that's not a sunk cost. Maybe that's, I don't know, opportunity cost. I don't know what that is, but I'm sure that there's some high
fluid. It's a bummer.
It is. Yeah, that's that for sure. But, you know, you're getting basically nothing out of your corner outfielders. You know, I Jason Hayward is looking longingly at Darwin Barney's stats at this point. You know, and Addison Russell is hitting .237.
Quit.
I'm just looking at batting average. I know the on-base percentage is decent there for most of them, except for Soler and Hayward. But yeah, I feel like, and earlier this week, you know, it's like Rizzo started out really strong. His numbers are still right there with Bryce Harper's, but he's cooled off a little bit. Oh, who steps up for him? Tommy LaFriggin Stella and Zen Brofist. You know, I mean, it's just kind of, there's, like you said, I can't remember who was singing it. But they were down one point earlier this week, down to nothing. And I was like, oh, yeah, well, when are they going to come back? Sure enough, they came back, and they were, and I think it was like, then it was 2-2, and then it was like 5-2, and then it was 8-2, you know, and it just, you just never, it never feels like the game is in doubt, because you feel like someone is going to make something happen. And you have to credit the front office, just the way that they've put this thing together. You know, last year it's like, well, and I just feel like they're so smart. And I was like, what happened against the Mets? Well, they just couldn't lay any wood on the ball. Okay, well, let's get a bunch of high contact guys in there, like Hayward, theoretically, and Zobrist. And, you know, they're just making contact. They're making pitchers work. And it's just amazing to see it all click like that.
Yeah, and I agree with all that. It is really fun to watch it happen that way. And I went to the game yesterday, and the wind was howling straight in. And, you know, where I was sitting, the wind was right at our face, so it was just like, it felt like it was 30 degrees. And on that day, I just thought the ball is not going to carry out of the park. The Cubs are going to struggle to get runs, and they were down 4-2 really early in that game with Hamill on the mound. And with Gio Gonzalez, who's a quality pitcher, thrown against him with the Nats, and I just thought, okay, that's it. This is the game they lose against the Nats. I didn't think there was a high probability that they were going to win all four, which they did. So I thought, okay, so this is the game they're going to lose. And then, sure enough, they end up scoring 8 runs. Bryant hits one out to left field halfway up the bleachers, somehow through the wind. There's just something weird and special about this team where they do all that. But back to Carlos's point about you know, things that have changed or that are different than we expected, players not performing. You know, how often did we hear in the offseason people saying that Miguel Montero was essentially untradeable because he was so valuable to this team with pitch framing and all the things that he does as a catcher from the catching standpoint? And they've essentially done all this with him on the DL with David Ross and Tim Fedorovich catching just about every day.
Yeah, and actually, I didn't get to see the game today, but I heard that Fedorovich was pretty rough.
It was terrible. But in fairness to Fedorovich, he's probably never caught anything even close to the movement that Arrieta has on his pitches. And pretty right away, like I was watching, I was going, I don't know. I mean, maybe David Ross really needed a day off, but I would have had Ross back there catching Arrieta. But anyway, go on.
Oh, I thought so too. And that was exactly the point I was going to make, is maybe you don't stick Fedorovich back there. Especially after Arrieta's last couple starts, he's been pretty erratic. So I was surprised to see Fedorovich back there. But to your point, it is pretty impressive as far as what they've done without Miguel Montero. But I look at the offense, and I actually don't see that many areas where the Cubs are going to regress strongly. Dexter Fowler is going to regress. There's no question. I think you're going to get some regression in guys like LaStella that have really, really played well, and even some of the contributions you've gotten from Matt Caesar. But the big guns, you know, the Bryants and the Rizzos, they're about where they're going to be, I think. But when I look at this team and you think about regression, it's coming in the starting pitching, and it's coming hardcore. Jason Hamill's been a lot more erratic his last two times out. He's really relying heavily on the slider, far more than normal. His last outing was at 43% usage on the slider. He's kind of abandoning the upper inner portions of the strike zone, which means that he's relying completely on ground balls, which is not a recipe for success for him. You've seen Jake Arrieta coming loose just a little bit, and essentially you've got three starters in the ones ERA-wise, and that's never going to last. So you've got regression coming from the starting pitching, and we need to realize that. But the point Ryan Davis made earlier, and I'll let him speak to it, is this roster is finally being used as it was constructed to be used. And I'll let you speak to that, Ryan.
Yeah, we talked about it last week about how they carry eight relievers for a reason, and you know, why were starters being pushed at that point? And I agree on the idea that I wouldn't want starters being pushed to go seven innings or eight innings. I don't want starters necessarily pulled after five, like we talked about with Lackey, where he threw like 60 pitches. That doesn't make any sense to me. But if a starter's at 80-plus after five, I think at this point in the season, especially with their record and the kind of bullpen they have, they can go ahead and pull them. So this week, sure enough, after we had that conversation, they've had, I think, all but two starts this week were only five-inning appearances. I think one of them was Lackey, who threw seven innings and struck out 12, and the other was Kyle Hendricks, who threw six shutout innings. So, yeah, they're definitely using the roster the way they intended to. The other point I wanted to make, when you were talking about the regression candidates with the pitching, I don't think it's just the starting pitching. I think it's the whole pitching staff.
Definitely.
They've got a 2.53 team ERA, but also a 3.07 FIP. So the FIP is quite a bit higher. It's a half a run higher than the ERA, and that's a point that I made on the Cardinals all year last year, saying, you know, they had the highest disparity of any team between the FIP and the ERA, and theirs was only like 0.3. It wasn't even close to what the Cubs are doing. And the other big thing that I see, 6.3 hits per nine for the team.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, for any one pitcher, you would say 6.3 is a really low number. 6.3 for the team. Rondon, 3.2 hits per nine. Strope, 3.4 hits per nine. Warren, 3.2 hits per nine. Those are insane numbers.
Never. Not sustainable. Yeah, not sustainable. Not at all. Well, and I think the FIP is an interesting point, because one of the byproducts of all this horrible weather that you've had in Chicago and nasty days to hit and the wind blowing in is the fact that pitchers aren't going to allow a lot of home runs, and you know the pitching stats are benefiting from that, and that's why you see this disparity between ERA and FIP. And to your point, that's going to change, and as the weather changes, you're going to see those ERAs rise and some general regression from the pitching.
No, you mentioned Adam Warren. How good does that Castro trade look now, considering that basically it was Castro for Warren and Zobrist, just because of the way the numbers worked out?
Excellent. It was such a good trade. I mean, it was a very intelligent trade, and I love Starlin Castro. But yeah, if you can make that trade where you get a good pitcher who could be a reliever and possibly a starter next year, for the team, and then also sign a guy like Ben Zobrist, who just won a World Series and, you know, does all the things that we see him do. Yeah, it's a no-brainer.
Agreed.
You know, and something I was thinking of when we were talking about the offense is there's that phrase, what is it, speed doesn't slump. And I feel like with this team, you know, despite some of the batting averages aren't so hot, but, you know, the patience and seeing pitches and just wearing pitchers down, like that so far has been pretty consistent. So I'm trying to get some new phrase, patience doesn't slump, something, because regardless of how the team is doing, and I think Ben Zobrist is a great example of this. You know, his numbers early on weren't fantastic. I mean, he really turned it on this week, and we'll talk a little bit about that now, but he was one of those guys just wearing pitchers down, and he, along with Anthony Rizzo, are two guys that have not just barely more walks than strikeouts, but a lot more walks than strikeouts. And if you've got that approach, you know, regardless of whether you get some bad luck and you hit balls right at guys, or maybe you have some you know, bad swings here and there, if your control of the zone and your patience is on point, you're going to be pretty consistent in how other teams just get worn down against you.
You know, it's funny because we were talking about earlier, like how we felt when the Cubs were down by 2 or 3, we didn't feel put off by that at all. And similarly, like I don't know if I'm projecting this on the other pitchers, but I feel like by like the third inning, they're like, oh shit, God, these guys are just wearing me down, you know. And I'm just looking at the number of pitches today. Zobrist saw 30 pitches. Fowler saw 27. And then Bryant is third, and at 22, and it's amazing to me that Bryant, you know, he's not having the flashy season, but his numbers are solid. His strikeout rate is down, and he I don't know. Maybe, I mean, he did hit the homer yesterday. He hit the tying single today, and then he hit what could have been the game-winning double. I was there at the game, and I wouldn't have sent Hayward, by the way. I think having runners at second and third with one out would be fine. I think that was an overly aggressive send on that play. But I think that just the philosophy of wearing the pitchers down, and just, I think it takes a toll, obviously, on their arms, but I think it takes a psychological toll, because you're getting into the bullpen, you're getting high pitch counts by the fourth inning, and then then there's that lineup, and there's not really a hole, you know. I mean, when you get toward the bottom of the lineup, you've got David Ross and then John Lester. Well, maybe that's a, you know, a little bit of a hole, but otherwise, it's just so solid 1 through 7.
The only thing I'm going to take issue with is, I know it's an unpopular opinion, but I was totally fine with that send. And this goes back to a larger sample that I've seen over the last year, is that since they brought in Joe Maddon and his staff, they've been very aggressive with sends, especially late in games, when we're talking about tying or winning situations. And I couldn't tell you exactly how many, and I probably don't even remember exact situations, but there were a lot of sends that I remember last year when they were winning that I thought, ooh, that's an aggressive send. That guy's going to be out at the plate. And then a throw airmails the catcher is offline and he gets in. I feel like that happened quite a bit. And those are the kinds of things where you forget it completely. He scored, so obviously it wasn't a bad send.
I see what you're saying. But
yeah, and today it took a perfect throw from Taylor in center to the cutoff man, and then who had to turn and make a perfect throw to the catcher. Both were perfect, and even then, the catcher was standing in the baseline, which I'm not saying that's like the bad call or anything. I'm just saying he was in the baseline, so Hayward had to slide around him and still was maybe within a foot of getting his hand on the base on home plate. So I feel like it was a fine send, because the other argument you can make is, well, what if Rizzo pops up to the catcher and makes out number two, which we can't say that he would have, but that is what he did in his at-bat. So, I mean, there's no guarantee that just because you don't send him that you actually end up scoring.
Right. No, I mean, I see what you're saying, and typically I tend to agree with being aggressive, but I mean, I was there with seats right along the first baseline. I saw the play kind of unfolding, and I saw when, I don't remember who made the relay, but I saw when he got the ball. And he was, like, Hayward was just barely around third. I'm like, yes, it did take a good throw, but I felt like it looked closer than it was. Just being at the game, it just seemed like, you know, we're getting kind of down into the weeds here in a week where they kicked serious ass, or like the one play. But but that said, I tend to agree with you normally, but I just, seeing that, I just felt like as soon as he turned to make the relay, I'm like, oh no, hold him. But, you know, all's well that ends well.
Hey, well, Joel, honestly, agreeing with Ryan normally, generally, is just a terrible life path to follow. You know, Lynn Casper, I was just reading Twitter, Lynn Casper is being very vocal about saying it was the right decision, which...
Lynn Casper.
Yeah, Ryan, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't it Revere in center or no?
I thought it was Taylor at that point.
Interesting, because Pat Hughes...
Looking back, Revere started in center.
Yeah,
he moved to left field, and Taylor came in.
Huh, that's interesting because Pat Hughes live, I was listening on the radio at that point, live, he called it as Revere, and I sort of assumed they sent him because Revere's noodle arm, but it makes a lot more sense now that it was Taylor and they actually managed to throw him out.
Yeah, I thought it was Taylor, but yeah, I'd have to look.
Huh, interesting.
Yeah.
But hey, Javi, right?
Exactly.
What did you guys think of? I mean, I wasn't watching. I was actually walking back from the park with my family, and we just heard an explosion, and I thought, oh, sweet, they won. And we walked by a bar, and I saw the replay. And I don't know. I'm still, like, every time I see him, it was a great, you know, it was a bomb. He pulled this, like, what was it, a slider, curveball, away, and he just went out there and yanked it in the deep left center field. You know, maybe it's being picky because obviously it's, you know, a great week and a game winner, but he's not going the other way with those pitches, which kind of bothers me.
Wasn't his other home run also a slider low and away, and he pulled it?
I think you're right.
It was.
Yeah.
I just keep having those flashbacks to the Cardinals game when he just didn't he take it the other way? It was like,
yeah, he did.
Yeah.
He did that against the Rockies. I mean, I think his first game he actually took it the other way too. Like, he can do it, but I don't know. Every time I see a young player who's still trying to, like, figure it out, yank an outside breaking ball.
It's that's the thing I was gonna say though. That's a hanging breaking ball, and I think it goes a little bit out the window when it's a thigh high hanger. The difference with last year's home run against Lackey is that was a 93, 94 mile an hour fastball off the plate outside. That's a pitch you have to go the other way with. These hanging breaking balls, I mean, if you're on it, you're on it. I don't know. I think I agree with your overall theory of it's a little scary, but in general, that's a pitch he's gonna hammer every time.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Just as a matter of point on that throw, it was Taylor, not Ben Revere.
Interesting. Yeah.
So if that changes anything at all for you.
I don't know. I just found
turns
it. Turns
my world upside down.
Yeah.
Well, let's move on and talk a little bit about Ben Zobrist. He woke up this week. I don't think I have the numbers incorporated for today's game, but before that, the previous six games, he went he hit .381. 444 on base percentage, slugged 1,000 with 4 home runs and 15 RBIs. And I think we're going to be doing this week after week where one player just blows up. Yeah. It's just the nature of the game. But but Ben Zobrist was already, he started the week with a .389 on base percentage, ends it with a .402. And he just, I mean, he was outstanding. He's turned it on, and he was one of the big reasons why the Cubs did so well. And I didn't expect to see him kind of turn it on with the power that he did, but it's nice to see.
The thing I think that's most exciting is if you go back and look at his stat lines from the last few years, his season thus far this year is really mirroring his 2012 season, in which he was a top 20 MVP player for the Rays. The .377 on base, .270 that year, he OPS plus .137, and right now he's at .136. But when I look at Ben Zobrist, the thing that's most exciting is he struck out 13 times this year, and he's walked 21 times.
Wow, I love seeing that.
He's not too far from 2-1 walk to strikeout. So that's the type of guy that's just going to generate so many runs one way or another, and that the power I just kind of view as a ancillary bonus.
And it was nice to see him in, I think he played right field this week. I think one of the first times, you know, this agreement that they had about, I'm going to play a lot of second base, but it was nice to see that, yeah, they're going to actually use his flexibility.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting that they did put him out there. I'm sure it is something where he doesn't mind going out there so long as they are pretty much sticking to the agreement where he plays basically every day second base. I think Zobrist has been fantastic, and I do think we are going to be talking about this all year, where they've kind of put themselves in a situation where, you know, this week Soler's struggling, Rizzo kind of cooled off a little bit after a hot stretch with home runs just the last couple of days. You know, Fowler had an off day, Hayward's continued to struggle, the catching situation, Ross started out really well but has been struggling at the bat. So this week Ben Zobrist, he's carried the team with 4 home runs and, you know, just insane. So I think it's going to be like this, where every week we're going to have a different guy who stepped up and, you know, had a hot stretch. So that's great when you have a team that this deep that you can do that.
You know, I want to go back for a second to Baez, because I was reading on Twitter and other places talking about, you know, his homer today, obviously, and, you know, his defense has been so amazing, and just he plays with such electricity. And, you know, I'm wondering, as you guys are talking, I'm thinking, how do you get him in the lineup more? Because I kind of feel like maybe you need to do that. And then do you put, you know, him at third and Bryant and left? And then, you know, you're losing LaStella, and he's obviously, you know, high contact guy, doesn't strike out very often at all. But, you know, to me, then I'm fine with him as your first guy off the bench, and he's kind of your utility guy. But I feel like Baez is kind of forcing the issue almost.
Man, Joel, and this is a pretty contentious point with Cubs Twitter, but to me, it is painfully obvious that Jorge Soler does not belong anywhere near this starting lineup right now. I don't know exactly why he gets so much rope compared to some other players. He's not on the level of Baez or LaStella right now. I don't think it's even close all around. LaStella hits line drives like they're going out of style, and Baez's all-around game is just so impressive. I don't get why you give Soler two starts in a row. I understand the playing time bit, and this is where I really side with Ryan for once, which I try hard not to do, but I really side with him in saying that if you feel the need to get him every day at bats, it needs to be in AAA. If you don't feel the need, if you feel like it's the best for the team, he needs to be your right-handed bat off the bench, and LaStella and Baez need to be in there every day.
Yeah, I'm coming around too to that.
Yeah, and there was only one thing that I disagree with what you said, and that's that he's had a lot of rope. I feel like he hasn't. He's basically, he didn't start a game for like 3 or 4 days.
Let me caveat that. Sorry. I'm just saying rope with fans and Cubs Twitter where they're complaining and arguing about him not playing.
Well, I think there's a lot of the opinion if he's not going to play at all, he's not helping, you know, the team. This isn't a guy like Javier Baez where he's got the insane defense and can play a whole bunch of different positions, where even if he's not hitting that well and he's not starting, he's still providing, you know, a backup at shortstop and can come in and play third base late, that kind of thing. This guy provides nothing defensively. He's not a base stealer. He's basically a hitter, and that's all he is. And if he does hit, he could be, you know, the potential is that he could be, you know, one of the best hitters in the game possibly. But right now he's just not. So I think there's a lot of people who are upset about the fact that he's not getting the chance to hit to show that he has value being on the roster, because if he's not, then you have to send him down. And so, I got into a conversation with Sahat of Sharma about it, where he basically was saying that he's fine with the way the Cubs are handling it, which I disagree with. And he said, you know, it's not like he needs to go down and work on something that he could work on at AAA at this point. It's the stuff at the major league level. If you send him down and start him every day at AAA, he's most likely just going to rake. And it's not going to fix any issues. My counter to that, which I think was too difficult to explain in 140 characters, was it's not about – we've seen that he can hit at the major league level. I think the problem right now is that he's not getting enough consistent playing time to be able to figure it out. He needs to be able to play consistently, and that's his issue.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't think there's anything there I disagree with. I think that other people have forced him out. And it's maybe less about Jorge Soler, and I think Joel said this. It's more about Tommy LaStella is hitting line drives every time he's up, virtually. And Baez is, he's been so good all around that I feel like other people have leapfrogged Soler. So then that's kind of question one to me. So maybe he doesn't belong in the lineup. And then question two is then how do you utilize him? Do you bring him off the bench? Is that good enough? Or does he need regular playing time? And, you know, I can hear both arguments on both sides of that.
So I'm curious, Isaac, how would you, if Soler doesn't belong in the starting lineup, what's your starting lineup? Is it Baez starting in left field and LaStella's the first bat off the bench?
No, I would have Bryant in left field and Baez at third. And it just depends on kind of who's on the mound. If it's a really tough righty, then probably Baez off the bench and LaStella playing on the infield somewhere with some combination of Bryant and Zobrist in the outfield. But I'm basically saying one of Baez or LaStella needs to be in there every day. I don't know. It's hard. I just feel like both of those guys have proven that they need to be in the lineup, and they look so much better than Soler right now.
I pretty much agree with that, and I think it should be a kind of a three-man rotation with Bryant, Baez, and Listella. Only Bryant obviously is going to play just about every day, and then occasionally, you know, you get Baez over at second base or shortstop to give those guys days off.
Sure,
so that,
yeah.
That's how I feel. So I think we're on the same page on that. The other note that I want to throw out there on Baez, his stat line is obviously higher than what you would expect out of him, a .333 on base and a .304 batting average or not, the kind of numbers you're going to get out of him playing for a whole season. But the slugging percentage is like .435. That's nothing insane. So the overall, from what you've had at Baez at the plate, I think it's not insane, but it's not way too low either.
Yeah.
He has a 0.4 WARP already this year in 17 games played.
Yeah.
Get your mind around that. That is heavily weighted
get
on
your mind around it.
On how good he is on defense. I mean, just think about what that would be in like 400 plate appearances. That would be a 4-win player at that rate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In 400 plate appearances.
I have a question for you guys. And maybe this is me going to traditional, but do you think there's any downside to just, I mean, we do it all the time, and I do it when I think of lineups, of Chris Bryant, put him in left, put him at third. For a young player in his second year in the bigs, and I know Joe Maddon loves his flexibility, and I think it's a great thing, but is there any downside to him just being randomly put in left, put third, put in left? Any downside to that at all for him as a developing player?
You know, Carlos, it's funny you asked that because I was going to ask you that question at some point because you're the guy who always, you know, can't stop talking about how you've played the game before and you're getting so tired of it and so jealous too. But no, I mean,
started our season today actually.
look forward to a 10-minute breakdown of the game.
I hit the game winner, just so you know.
That's good to know.
opposite field line drive right over the shortstop.
So anyway,
the play
like
was,
I was
let
saying,
me break down the play.
Let me tell you about my fantasy team now.
Yeah, I had this dream last night.
Will you guys tell me whether I should make this fantasy trade?
Star Wars. I'm wondering if... nice. I wonder if you're the one who should be able to tell us that. I mean, I've wondered that exact question. Like, it doesn't seem to affect Baez, but I know that, you know, like one of the knocks on Mike Quadi, for instance, was like, guys, you know, it's probably the only knock on Mike Quadi, right? Was that the guys would come to the park and they wouldn't know where they were batting, and sometimes be batting third, and sometimes be batting sixth, and so. I wonder if consistency is something that helps them, you know, stay sharp. But at the other, you know, and you could make the other point. Well, you know, if you never know where you're playing, then you always have to kind of be aware. And you know, the thing is, I guess to throw my own answer out is, I just trust Maddon. I think that he is probably so friggin' smart that whatever he's doing is right.
So are you going to let me answer your question, or are you just going
to... No, I'm just going to keep going. Because I feel like you're just going to go back to today's game. You're just going to have to back with that. So,
no, I mean,
Carlos, what is your take?
I think that there's... it depends on the person, right? I mean, I think Chris Bryant, he's already, in a way, even though it's his second year, he's established. Everybody sees that he's a stud. So there's no... I don't think he has any insecurities about, oh, if I go out there and I look bad, is it going to reflect poorly on me and people are going to be down on me?
I don't like you using that voice for Chris Bryant, by the way. Just want you to know, I find that really offensive.
So he's in. Javi Baez, he's an infielder, and shortstops can play anywhere. So if he plays anywhere in the infield, it's not that big a deal. But if he was getting a lot of playing time in the outfield, especially center field, which is something that was discussed in the offseason, that I would feel, you know, he's trying to learn something new while he's trying to figure out his offensive game. And, you know, despite, I think Maddon did the smart thing in telling him and telling the media, listen, we see him as an everyday player, but this year the best thing for him and to help us for this team is to contribute in the way that he's contributing, using his defense, using his flexibility, and we'll get you back into the starting rotation later, but for this season, this is the plan.
Yeah, and it's interesting because Madden to me, I actually disagree with his in-game management a fair bit, not to go all True Blood on this conversation, but I love Madden as a person, as a people manager. I think he's an 80-grade people manager, and you know, I think he's a solid game manager, but I do question his decisions a fair bit.
Do you think you're a better strategist than Madden?
I did not say that.
But the implication was clear.
I think Isaac thinks he's a better tactician than Joe Madden. That's what I heard you say.
I think I hear you saying you're a better front office guy than Theo Epstein.
That's I have a real point here, actually.
Sick of Twitter.
My point is you,
at Isaac C. Bennett.
Is we're talking about guys that will be on this Cubs team for another 5 years between Bryant and Baez. And while I do think it might actually have a small kind of impact on how comfortable they are in-game, moving them around all these different positions, I think that Madden is trying to pattern them to get used to it. So, you know, over the next 5 years, it becomes something they're very accustomed to and very comfortable to. So I think it's a little bit of the long play for Madden rather than, you know, just focusing on April 2016 to make them feel like they're versatile players and not get them stuck in ruts and really just get them comfortable being uncomfortable.
Yeah, I mean,
I should put that on a T-shirt.
Yeah.
Get comfortable being uncomfortable.
I like that. After all that ribbing, I came up with a nice little tag.
There you go.
Yeah, you rolled with it. But I think you're what we were talking about before is I think if the bottom line is we want to win, then I don't see how you keep Baez out of the starting lineup. And I'm just kind of just off the top of my head, I think that the best way you do that is you Baez at third, Brian in left.
Well, I think I think we touched on something like this last week where, yeah, put him in there. Give him a couple of weeks of everyday at-bats, and then very quickly you'll find out if you're comfortable with that. I mean, we probably would be on the defensive side, but if he goes into one of those horrible slumps where he's just hacking at everything and striking out like crazy and leaving guys on base, then maybe you start to, you know, change your tune a little bit, but we won't know until we see it.
Here's the thing, though. While I agree with that in principle, Joel, Ryan made the point about 0.4, I think he said warp, in 17 games for Baez. In 18 games, and I'm looking at Baseball Reference, so it's war, forgive me, BP. But in 18 games, Tommy La Stella has a 0.8 war in only 18 games. So he's hitting .356 and slugging .667. How do you leave that out of the lineup right now?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's only so many positions, you know, and I think that...
That's what she said.
Oh, wow.
Wow. No, that's fine, you know.
It was the Happy Mother's Day?
Oh, my goodness.
Keeping it classy on Mother's Day.
We had such a nice show planned out, and we were going to go deep and talk about our moms.
Oh.
That's an unfortunate juxtaposition of phraseology.
I was waiting for Carlos to say he only goes deep when talking about Joel's mom.
Carlos, you were playing T-ball today, right? That was a settlement T for you.
Well, let me explain to you what I was playing up.
But, you know, I guess if you're looking at, like, I mean, just obviously Stella probably going to regress a little bit, right? You're talking about candidates for regression. He's probably, you know, I think we know what he is, and it's good, but I don't think he's that good. But Baez, maybe he's going to regress a little bit too, but he just brings so much. He's, like I called him a couple weeks ago, the Tasmanian devil out there with his base running, with his fielding, with that cannon for an arm. You know, even if he's striking out three times like he did a couple nights ago, he's still making great plays. He still brings so much in other ways. I just feel like, you know, and I feel like he really is forcing the issue, and I feel like it won't be long before we see him getting a more prominent role.
I think what's exciting about La Stella, and I agree with you on Baez, and it's a good problem to have for sure, and that's one of the reasons why you can see the injuries that we've seen, which Schwarber out, Caesar out, Hayward was out for a period of time. But when I look at La Stella, I think what excites me the most is that his hard contact is 32.5%. His medium contact is 52%. So 85% of the time he's either hitting the ball relatively hard or very hard, and he only has 15% soft contact. So the numbers there are really strong, and it speaks to his high BABIP being relatively sustainable. It's not always going to be 368, but it speaks to him being a player that will have a high BABIP.
Yeah, I just want to jump in real quick here, real fast, just so you know. Jorge Soler's soft contact is 13%, and his medium and hard contact is about 87%.
But
so,
it's the contact.
Just so you know.
It's the contact that's part of the issue, though.
So.
What's his K percentage? I mean, La Stella's is 9.
Yeah, Jorge Soler's is, let's just say, higher than that.
Right, that's the big problem. It's 20, not that he doesn't...
It's 21%.
That's actually not that terrible.
It's still a problem for Jorge Soler that when he hits the ball really hard in play, he's often hitting it right at guys. It happens to him at third base today.
Yeah.
He smoked the ball right at third base, and it was an out. I mean, it still happens to him way too frequently, and it comes back down to the whole playing time issue is when that happens to him and then he doesn't get back in the lineup. I mean, it just prolongs how bad he looks.
So, and I'm sorry to go back to this, I really am, but Ryan, is your position still that you would send him to AAA at this time to get him more playing time, or that you would start him more often at this level?
I would probably give him another couple weeks in the major leagues and get him into the lineup as frequently as possible to see if you can get him enough mm-hmm. at-bats. I mean, look, they've played 30 games this year, and he's gotten into 29 of them. It's not like he's sitting on the bench forever. Yeah. A lot of the times he starts, plays half the game, and then Baez or La Stella or both come into the game like today. Both Baez and La Stella did not start today, and both of them got several plate appearances. Baez was 1-for-3 with the game-winning home run. So not every game is going to go 13 innings, but I think if you're starting Soler and bringing those guys in, at least give him a little longer. If he starts to hit, then great. If not, then he needs to get consistent at-bats, and they need somebody else on the bench who can actually help.
Well, you mentioned sending Soler back to AAA, so we've talked a lot about the Major League team, what the players are doing. Epstein and company have talked about this team setting it up to win for the long term, so that means that there's got to be some talent coming up from the farm system, and we want to spend a little bit of time talking about some of those guys at AAA. So, Ryan, I know you had a couple guys that you wanted to discuss, so you want to start us off?
Yeah, I just kind of was looking back at some of the AAA stats, and I noticed they've got a lot of guys down there who I think Cubs fans will recognize the names, like Dan Vogelbach, Albert Almora, Wilson Contreras, Pierce Johnson, Carl Edwards Jr., and there's a lot of really interesting stuff going on there. I think it probably doesn't surprise a lot of people to find out Pierce Johnson just went on the DL with an injury. Had started out, has been walking people. Carl Edwards Jr. has looked good striking out guys, but he's still walking people. I just feel like there's a lot of really interesting names down at AAA, and there's also another guy that I think a lot of Cubs fans probably haven't heard of or heard minimal about, and that's starting pitcher Ryan Williams, who I think is 24 years old, and is probably, if the Cubs needed to call up a starting pitcher to start a game, he's probably the pitching prospect that is the closest to the major leagues right now.
Yeah, and he's pretty interesting. You mentioned this earlier as well, but he's a little bit in the Kyle Hendricks mold where he doesn't throw very hard. I think he tops out at about 91 on a good day. He's more of an 89-90 guy, but very good control. And his first start was really, really rough. I think he gave up 8 earned runs, and his second one wasn't great either. But since then, he's got 4 consecutive wins, and he's throwing really well. He threw 8 innings today and pitched well. So he's a guy that I feel like is a really excellent spot starter if we happen to have an injury. I'm fairly excited that he's there for that kind of 4A depth, and I hope he's a back-of-the-rotation starter in the future for the Cubs, but he's definitely a great insurance policy for today.
Yeah, and I pulled this up. This is from last year real quick on Ryan Williams. This is by Todd Johnson, who wrote up a really nice profile about him, and, I mean, he looks like a starting pitcher, but he also looks like a lumberjack. And if you look at his picture, he looks like he looks like Jake Arrieta and Jason Hamill had a baby.
And Jason Wirth involved in there anywhere somewhere?
No, it's not. I mean, he's
settled down, Joel.
He's the same beard style and everything. And he talks about you're right on with the velocity. 90 to 92 is about where he sits. He has a 12-6 curveball that sits 82 to 84, which is pretty good. It sounds like it's a really good pitch for him. And there's a quote from him in here that says, "I'm more of a locations guy. I try to put as much movement on the ball as possible. My job is to make hitters swing and make a mistake and let my defense work for me." So that sounds very much like he's a Kyle Hendricks type.
Yeah, I was looking through some of the stats down at AAA, and one thing that jumped out at me, because I mentioned before I love seeing guys that walk more than they strike out, Wilson Contreras has 14 walks and 11 strikeouts. He's doing really well off to a good start. Second best prospect in the system, so I'm sure fans out there are aware of him. But another guy that coming up to AAA for the first time, Albert Almora. He actually has 49 total bases to Contreras' 43, and he's off to a terrific start up there.
Yeah, he is. Really just going up and down that lineup, and you always have to take this with a grain of salt because there's a lot of guys in AAA that aren't prospects, but Logan Watkins started and led off today, but typically that's John Andreoli's spot. And so if you go Andreoli, Almora, Contreras, Vogelbach, I mean, 2, 3, 4, those are all very legitimate prospects, and they're hitting 318, 349, and 330. Contreras is OBPing 452. Wow. Vogelbach's OBP is way up there as well. So Vogelbach is going to get traded. There's no more sure bet to get traded, I think, in all of the minor leagues than Dan Vogelbach. But that is an unbelievably good lineup, and that's ignoring Arizmendi Alcantara, who's really come on lately. He's hitting a ton of extra base hits. When I was there last week, he hit one of the most impressive triples that I've seen in a while, just a rocket shot off the right field wall, and he just cruised in the third for a triple. You still got Kawasaki down there. Taylor Davis just came back up. Shane Victorino's there. It's a really, really fun team, and I would encourage anybody listening to head over to Des Moines and check them out.
You know what? One good move, I mean, there's a lot of good moves, but kind of an underrated move. Spencer Patton, who, got called up and I think gave up a run, got no outs, so his ERA is infinity right now at the big league level. But
is that good or bad?
It's very good. 10 innings pitched, 17 strikeouts, hadn't allowed an earned run down at AAA. He was looking fantastic down there. He was closing games down.
That's basically what he did in spring training, right? I don't know that he
didn't
gave
allow an earned run there either.
Struck out like 2/3 of the guys he faced. He has got a really live arm, and I'm actually excited to see him at the big league level.
You talked about Alcantara. I kind of looked it up real quick. Over his last 11 games, 268 batting, 348 on base, 488 slugging with a home run, two triples, two doubles. So that's all really good stuff. The big number I'm seeing in 46 plate appearances, 15 strikeouts.
Yeah, and that's too high, and it's still a problem. He hit another home run today, which was his third of the season and second in the last 4 days, I think, so that his game today wasn't factored in. But yeah, the strikeouts are still there, and I say all that, and his talent is still so tantalizing. It's just that, that slider gets him, man.
The other interesting note that I'm seeing here, and this is on Baseball Reference where it's just listing the position that he started the game at, I think, but basically all season, second base, nothing else.
So they abandoned that center field experiment?
It sounds like he had no third base, no shortstop, no outfield. Yeah.
I wonder if that's...
They actually DH'd him one game, I remember seeing.
Yeah. They do have a lot of outfielders. I mean, between Almora and Andreoli both playing center, it's...
Yeah. Murtaugh!
Yeah. Yeah, it says 20... Says he's played 22 games and 22 starts at second base, and it doesn't list any DH, no outfield, nothing else.
So are you guys with me though that come July 1 or probably July 31, Dan Vogelbach will be wearing a different uniform?
Probably.
You would think so.
I don't think they're in any big hurry to trade him, but yeah, I mean, if you can involve him in a deal somewhere else as this is the guy they need to get the deal done, I think you absolutely do. You don't hold on to him and say, no, we can't give you Dan Vogelbach. How dare you ask for Dan Vogelbach? But I don't think they're just like, the Cubs didn't make any major moves other than they traded Dan Vogelbach for a pitching prospect. Like, I don't think they're out there doing that.
Correct me if I'm wrong, though. Won't he be Rule 5 eligible after this year, which is why I say that he'll be traded this year?
I mean, you can still put him on the 40-man and not call him up. I mean, if you don't use him... If you don't use him in a trade at the deadline, you can still use him in the as a trade in the off season or at the deadline next year.
Yeah.
I mean, it it's his first year at AAA. If he's hitting this well, and he is, you can still trade him somewhere when need be. But I'm just making the point. I don't think they're running out and trading him just to trade him.
Yeah, you're right. They'll probably put him on the 40 man and then and go that direction.
We know how they've dug their heels in when they. Anytime someone says, "Well, they obviously have to do this move," they obviously have to move Wellington Castillo now because they'll have three catchers. No way they start the season with three catchers, and you know, oh well, obviously they have to move Jorge Soler now because no way they can start the season with four outfielders. I mean, they just dig their heels in and don't do it.
Yeah, I think more than anything, it's if he continues to play this well, I'm not sure his value can ever get any higher than it will be as he crushes the ball in AAA. And you know, if they go to look to add another stud pitcher, he's going to be right at the top of the list, I think, of guys that make sense to move.
Yeah, I agree. Well,
it was fun to take a look at some of these AAA guys. Maybe next week, if the fans were fond of this segment, maybe we'll take a look at the AA and start kind of going down the levels. Until then, Joel, can you tell us who's going to be the star of 60 Seconds? I mean, you're the star, but who's going to be the featured
the subject
player? Yeah.
The subject is mid-70s first baseman / outfielder Pete LeCocq.
Happy Mother's Day.
All right, Joel, take it away.
Okay. With the 20th pick, the Cubs tugged Pete LeCocq's name out of the envelope in the 1970 draft. LeCocq leaned left at the plate in the first base pack, and he led the Texas League in bases on balls in 1972. LeCocq became a member of the Cubs in the summer of 72, and they're a fairly firm unit, finishing second with a solid 85-70 record in a hard division. No one blocked LeCocq from starting, but essentially the mustachioed first baseman slash outfielder was just another Tom, Dick, or Harry. LeCocq's proudest moment was when he jacked a grand slam off Bob Gibson. thrusting Gibson into retirement. LeCocq felt shafted when the coach when the Cubs finished his unsatisfying Northside career early and traded him to the Royals in 1977. He was
keep going.
He was never cock of the walk in Kansas City either, although fans never teased LeCocq for his soft swing. LeCocq's Northside stats were pretty flaccid altogether, but one number stands tall. If you remove his rookie year when he had just six at bats, well, LeCocq's RBI total as a Cub, 69.
No, no.
Swear to God.
No.
Well done.
Oh.
Thank you for making me cry.
Snuggles LeCocq.
Let me just mark this as rated R.
It was all legitimate.
Mother's Day.
It all fit together. You got to admit, there's nothing gratuitous there.
Happy Mother's Day.
I think you got to turn the clock off on that one.
Oh, yeah. No,
I mean, yeah. Went out the window.
I think we have to turn everything off.
I got it. Man, it took me so long to write that thing. There's only so many penile references you can.
Did you run that by Jean just to see if that was cool?
She'd be on the phone with the divorce lawyer if she had heard that.
I for one really enjoyed having this podcast with you guys.
We had a good run.
It was a good run. Yeah,
we have nothing left to prove in this game.
I'm alluding to the fact that we're gonna get canceled.
Oh yeah, we're getting canceled.
Censored.
We're all getting fired.
And it's confirmed we all have the maturity of 11-year-old boys. So
I didn't hysterically at dick jokes. Yeah, we definitely. Did.
Wait, there were dick jokes in there?
I didn't get this in either because it was
I bet you did.
Oh, God.
All right, force it in there. Come on now.
His dad was Peter Marshall, host of the show Hollywood Squares.
Thank you for that anecdote. Excellent.
Yes, there's the cherry on top.
Wow.
I thought you were going to say he was like an actor in Different Strokes or something.
Nice.
Very well done.
Oh, I didn't get stroke in there. Damn. Can I do it again?
Yeah, just run it over from the top.
Yeah.
I'm going to talk about a sweet stroke on at bat of the week. So.
Well, there's nice a segue if I've ever heard one.
Yeah, wow. There you go. Go for it.
All right, at bat of the week. Moving on. Wow. I have no idea how to follow that up. So I'm just going to go for it.
Go for it.
Just pick an Addison Russell at bat.
Oh, you know what? There was a couple of awesome ones, and I literally just can't do it. And I thought about Javi today as a game winner, but I'm going to go back. And I think I mentioned the story once before, but 2 years ago in Round Rock, I met Ryan Kalish and was highly impressed by the approach that he took and adamantly telling me that he should not be in the major leagues and that he needed to be at AAA and he needed to get some seasoning and work his swing out, and that's where he believed he belonged. And I hadn't really ever heard a player say that. Most of them say that they believe they belong at the biggest level. So Ryan Kalish left an impression on me that stuck with me a couple years later. So after missing most of last year, I was thrilled to see him back with the big league team this year, even if it was due to a couple of injuries. So some unfortunate circumstances, but nevertheless, I was excited to see him. So yesterday, the Cubs were losing 4-2 in the sixth inning in the aforementioned game that I never really felt like we were in any doubt of losing, but it was 4-2 in the sixth inning, and we started off Chris Bryant with a line-out to center fielder, Ben Revere. I'm certain it was Ben Revere. Anthony Rizzo singled. Ben Zobrist was out on a sacrifice bunt where he was actually bunting for a base hit. So two outs, one on. Jorge Soler singled. Addison Russell singled. Bases loaded. Tommy La Stella walked. Sorry, that actually loaded the bases because Russell's was an RBI single. So bases loaded for Ryan Kalish with two outs. He got down 1-2, took a ball, and then fouled off a really, really good Sammy Solis fastball. It was about 4 inches off the plate outside, kind of a borderline pitch. It was a big strike zone yesterday. So borderline pitch, fouls off a fastball. The next fastball, sure enough, is right down Broadway, and he kind of fists it into left field softly, but managed to get it through. Two-run single for Ryan Kalish. The tying run scored. They never looked back. It was an 8-5 Cubs winner on the Ryan Kalish game-tying single in the sixth inning.
That was a big at-bat. We were actually we were walking around the ballpark at that point, going to meet up with some friends. And, that was huge. The place went nuts. My daughter ended up, like, we're walking, and she, we were watching it while we were walking, and she covers her ears because it got so loud for her. That was a really big moment in that game, and it was also really big for Kalish.
Yeah, just great to see a kind of a guy that's really struggled through some crazy injuries, neck and back injuries, and been through, I believe it's 9 different surgeries on his neck and back, which is pretty hard to fathom when you think about it. And he's still playing at a big league level, and just to come up and play such a big role in that moment for a really good team, that it's got to really be gratifying for his career. I was very excited to see it.
Good pick. That was a good choice.
Yeah. The only other thing that the Baez at bat today I think would have been a great pick too, mostly because he took 2 pitches for balls to start the at bat and then took some mighty swings after that, like ready to just pound on one.
Yeah.
Yeah, like he just wanted to, like he, okay, so now I took 2 balls and now I can try and pound the next 2 pitches, and then he swung and missed, and then I think he fouled a couple off before connecting on that home run.
Yeah, right or wrong, my reasoning was that I feel fairly confident that Javi Baez will make an appearance in a later at-bat of the week, and I'm not so sure I can say that for Ryan Kalish, so I needed to squeeze him in there.
Fair enough.
All right, well, today is Mother's Day, so we wanted to spend a little bit of time kind of talking about our moms. For me, I remember I was 6 years old. My mom said, hey, you want to sit down with me and watch this baseball game? Right. Question of the week. I'm sorry.
Whoa.
I went into the emotional story with my mom too soon.
Oh man, I don't even know.
We're just not ready for it.
Okay, look, we don't want our moms to listen to this podcast this week.
Question
Joel
of the week.
Made sure. Yeah, Joel made sure that we don't want anyone to hear it.
Let's go to you, Ryan.
All right. So this question came from listener Brad, who describes himself as the biggest Cubs fan in Switzerland, no relation to Snuffleupagus. And he brings up the Hayward slow start that we kind of teased around this whole podcast. And he talks about slow start. He basically wants to know our take on
what we're thinking about Hayward. And I'll start us off with some numbers. You guys brought up the soft, medium, hard percentage, not when you were talking about Pete Lecocq. sorry. Hayward's soft percentage is 22.2%. I'm sorry, that's for a career. I'm looking at it wrong. His soft percentage, that's for career, 22.2%. This year, up to 28.9%. His hard percentage on hard balls in play, 17.1%. Stop making me laugh. 17.1% on a hard contact. He's basically been hitting everything on the ground. So I'll start off with that. What do you guys think about the specific contact that Hayward's been having?
I think one thing that's a little scary is you mentioned that his ground ball rate is high, but it's 46%, and his career average is 49, almost 50%. So his ground ball percentage is actually lower than his career average. Last year he hit ground balls at a 57% clip, and this year he's at 46%. The thing that's really scary about this is that his infield fly ball percentage, also known as a pop-up, thanks Fangraphs, his infield fly ball percent is 18.2, where his career average is 12.6. So he's 6 points over his pop-up rate, which, honestly, I came into tonight before I kind of researched this thinking, I'm not that worried about it, he's just hitting the ball on the ground too much. It's actually the opposite. He's hitting the ball on the ground less than he normally does, and he's popping everything up, which is maybe a sign of a slightly bigger issue.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I'm pretty unconcerned now, but hearing those numbers and, you know, hearing about the change in approach that the Cubs wanted him to take to kind of drive things and hit more balls in the air, it'll be interesting to see how it plays out if it's that and how that approach goes, if it is a change in approach, or if it's just him starting off slow the way he usually does and it's going to be the same old him the rest of the season.
Hmm. All right, so here's scary stat number two. the percentage of fastballs seen since 2010 with the Braves, I'll go season by season, 57%, 58, 55, 59, 60, 60, and then 2016 with the Cubs, 70%.
Mm-hmm.
He's seeing 70% fastballs at the plate right now. Hmm. Any concern there?
Well,
I don't know.
I mean, I'm just – the thing, you know, I had mentioned before, I was at the game today, and I didn't see – I mean, he had one ball that went through on the, between the first baseman and second baseman, but he just – like, there was no pitch where you're like, oh, man, he took a great cut. Like, he just – you know, this fastball thing, maybe he's just late getting around. I don't know what it is, and I mean, I know we were talking about it before we started here, and Ryan, you were saying, or Isaac, I think you were saying that his numbers historically for this part of the season are usually pretty slow. But I don't know, man. We're in the end of the second week of May here. Like, at what point do we say this is becoming a little bit of an issue?
Do you want me to throw those numbers out before we go on?
Yeah, go ahead.
Those down to two. All right. So coming into today's game. 202 batting average, 313 on base, 253 slugging. He's got five doubles, no triples, no homers. And that's through 29 games. Today was game number 30. 2015 through 24 games, 211, 268, 333.
Hmm.
2014 through 26 games, 206, 292, 308. 2013 through June 18th, which was 47 games for him because he was injured, but 47 games through June 18th, 214, 317, 347.
There's the closest correlation right there.
Yep.
Yeah, and you bring up a good point here, Joel, because they talked about approach changes for him, trying to unlock more power, and you know, everybody comped him to Evans, Dwight Evans. And what's interesting is that was all before the season, so it's not like they hid what they were trying to do with him. So you're seeing a spike in people throwing him fastballs. In my opinion, his swing has looked a bit long at times, like he's trying to hit the ball with more elevation and hit it harder maybe than he normally did. He's a little bit of a slap hitter. So you're seeing a 70% fastball rate combined with a longer swing and a lot of pop-ups, which mean that he doesn't have his swing ironed out. yet he's late on pitches and he's not connecting for hard contact because I think he's late. So it's probably a confluence of events here where the league maybe said, okay, you're going to try and hit the ball farther with more loft. We're just going to throw you fastball so you're behind him. And that's exactly what's happening. He is hitting fly balls, but they're just on the infield, and his swing is maybe lengthened out just a touch too long, and he's not getting around like he should.
Yeah, I mean, let's not forget, you know, teams, the advanced scouting that teams have is extremely thorough, so they know that he struggles. So, and if he continues to struggle season after season early on, and they know maybe about this potential change in approach, then yeah, just if he's not throwing the heater, just keep throwing it and throwing it and throwing it until he either adjusts or that number is going to start, you know, keep creeping higher, right?
Yeah, this is part of what's brilliant about Hayward, too, though, is he's really struggling. I think we can all admit that, and the contact numbers bear it out and everything else. But he's still walking at a 13% clip, which leaves that on base at a relatively acceptable 313. So it's not like he's been worthless up there, and part of that's his ability to get on base.
I can make everybody feel better about it.
Please.
This has nothing to do with Pete LeCocq.
No, not at all.
Forget it.
I thought we were okay.
Give me 1 second because I didn't have it up immediately. I was gonna list off. I've been trying to bounce back and forth while giving you guys all the stats. All right, here it is. His career OPS in June is 807, 778 in July, 872 in August. So.
I feel fine.
Does that make anybody feel better about this?
Yeah, a little bit.
His career OPS in April is 705.
I don't know. I just love watching him play defense. I really do. Yeah. It's just he's a joy to watch play defense. He's getting on base. I think he'll figure it out. I'm not worried.
Like I said, he started late. He started slow every single year for the last 3-4 years now. So. I think the long-term message here is no matter how we break it down about what specifically is wrong, the track record says he's going to pick it up.
Agreed.
Anybody know why Tanner Roark is trending on Twitter?
Yes.
Roark.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it is pronounced Roark, which I learned this week.
Roark, yeah.
Yeah, somebody, I heard it said, and I was like, why are they saying Roark wrong? And then I heard Len Casper say it that way, too, and I always defer to Len. The reason he is trending is because of the Cubs' strategy against Bryce Harper of walking him every single time he came up. Roark called it scared baseball.
Yeah, fine. It's also winning baseball. We just swept you.
that's my response to it as well. If you don't like it, maybe don't complain to the media. Maybe go to your manager and say, put somebody behind Harper that's not going to go 1-for-7 with 14 men left on base.
Which is a major league record, by the way.
Was it really?
Yeah, the previous single game record for leaving men on base was 12 in a game.
Wow. Yeah.
So. Dusty Baker's so angry at Bryce Harper for clogging up those bases.
Oh, horrible.
Horrible. Come on, Bryce.
The one quote he will never live down.
Yeah, no. I'm loving all these fans hating on the Cubs, and I'm reveling in how Cardinals fans are pretending they don't care about baseball anymore, which is fantastic. And many other teams are just, you know, saying things like scared baseball.
Yeah,
I'm enjoying it.
Here's perhaps the definitive line about this. Keith Law, his tweet just now, asked for comment on Roark's remarks. Ryan Zimmerman grounded out weekly to second.
So good.
Done.
That is, yeah, you can say a lot of things about Keith Law, but he's on point with that.
That's funny.
Yeah.
All right. Is it time to get to our Mother's Day special here? We wanted to just spend a little bit of time here, and I'll just be brief with my memory. And it was just my mom's asking me if I wanted to watch a baseball game with her. I'd never watched a baseball game before. I think I was five, six years old. And I said, sure, I want to sit down and hang out with you. And I did. And I watched one game, and I just was entranced. And I wanted to go. I asked her to sign me up right away. I wanted to go and play baseball. She played catch with me a few times, and I was like, I love this game. I want to play. I want to watch it, and I want to be totally engrossed with it. And it really started with my mom. So Mom, I know you're not listening, but thanks anyway. I appreciate it, and happy Mother's Day.
I have somewhat similar. I don't have any specific memory. Kind of growing up, we didn't watch a ton of sports in my house, but as I got a little bit older, my interests were kind of all over the map, and my parents were trying to, I think, hone my interests into something specific, and we started watching baseball games more frequently in 1998 with the Cubs, and I really got interested, and my mom had always followed, just kind of from a distance, but always loved baseball, and so she saw that I was getting interested, so she kind of nurtured that interest and really helped me along with that and encouraged me to learn more, and my dad got the same thing. He bought me Moneyball when it came out and told me to read it because a coworker of his had suggested it. And, so if I could say any one person caused my real love of baseball, my mom really nurtured that for me. So also probably will never hear this, but thank you very much, Mom. I love you.
Yeah, and I definitely hope that my mother will continue her streak of not listening to the podcast after this disaster. Thanks, Joel. But
skip right to the end, moms, please.
Yeah, gracious. Fast forward.
Yeah, but for me, my parents were extremely instrumental in my love of sports, and my dad was always a huge sports fan and Cubs fan, and played baseball and really encouraged us to play from a very young age and coached us all throughout. And so he was coaching, and the thousands of games that my poor mother had to sit through on scalding, blistering, hot Illinois humid summer days, and she was just always there, always supporting us. And it's interesting because I've really seen my mother's fandom as a Cubs fan grow over the last 6 or 7 years since I've been out of the house and my other brothers have been out of the house, because she tells me that when she's got Pat Hughes and Ron Coomer now, or Lynn Casper and JD as it would be today on the TV, as she's got them blasting throughout the house, it reminds her of when all of her boys were home and playing Pat and Ron, dearly beloved Ron Santo, on the radio, on 6 or 7 different radios throughout the house. In those days, we didn't have cable. So we would play them, and now my mom tells me that she listens to or watches every game, and it reminds her of her sons being home. So she's often texting me before I even see the result with kaboom or something of that nature when KB hits a home run. Her obsession with Bryant might be a little over the top, but I assure you that he's still yours, Joel. So.
Okay, I was about to say. I feel bad. You guys did these very kind of earnest and touching odes to your mother.
Why do you hate your mom, Joel?
Oh, and I love you, Mom, by the way. I do love you very much.
See, there you go. Like, my mom didn't really. She was never really a huge sports fan. She liked the Cubs if we had them on, but she was fine without them. She basically, her way of nurturing my love of baseball was to let my brother and I take the train down from Evanston to games at Wrigley when we were way too young. I mean, I remember doing when I was like 9 or 10. My brother's 2 years older than me, so he's, we're 12 and 10 going down on the train ourselves and watching, Steve Swisher and Mike Vail and Jose Cardinal and, those awesome guys. George Mitterwald, of course.
The 40s were a different time, Joel. It was a lot safer back then.
That's true.
What was it like seeing Stan Hack in person?
Phil Cavaretta was a real stud.
Mordecai Three Fingers Brown was unforgettable. I think she respected that we loved it and, kind of nurtured it in the sense that she let us pursue our passions with it. So, it wasn't anything that she really pushed, but she let us follow our passion there. So for that, I'm very grateful.
That's beautiful. Have you ever considered being a writer? Your poignance and elegance is just unbelievable.
I don't think
Matt Magazine is looking for writers.
I've got a contract at Swank.
what does Hillary Swank want to do with you?
Absolutely nothing.
Very little.
No.
All right. Well, it's been a good one, guys.
It hasn't.
It's been the best one. But for the listeners out there, send us your questions. It was a good one this week. We appreciate that one. And especially the reference to Snuffleupagus. You can reach us on Twitter at BP Wrigleycast or email BPWrigleycast@baseballperspectives.com. Let's see what the Cubs have in store this coming week. Good night, guys.
Okay.
Night.
See ya.